nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
All right, so this is the last lecture about resistance. Then we'll move on to something new on Wednesday. So we talked about 1D resistors. 2 and 3D resistors are pretty much the same. So the mathematics is just a little more complicated, and I don't want to go through that because people tend to fall asleep, but I'll make a few remarks about it so that we can deal with these problems if we have to. So we've talked about these 1D resistors, just nanowires. There may be one subband, or there may be two, three, or four, some small countable number, depending on how small the nanowire is. And we've seen that it's easy to analyze these. We remember at T equals zero, the conductance is 2q squared over h, this quantum of conductance times the transmission. If I've got three subbands, I just add three of these, and I have the transmission at each one. For t greater than zero, we have to perform an integral, and we get these Fermi functions of various orders. And depending on what the energy dependence of the transmission is, when we do that integral involving energy, we get Fermi-Dirac integrals of different orders. You know? And when you're analyzing real experiments and you're trying to quantitatively extract information, you have to worry about things like that. But we can do that. So we'll get some average transmission or I guess this is a definition here of the average transmission. You just do the integral over energy space, and you have to know what the energy dependence of the transmission or mean free path is. All right, so I want to briefly just describe another way, the way that most people describe this problem. You know, so if you read most books about quantum of conductance, they'll do it a little bit differently than we've been doing it. So let me think about, you know, we presented this generic model for a small device described by some density of states. Could have been a molecule, but we said for this class we're going to assume that we can describe the density of states by some dispersion, some E of K. That's what we're doing in this course. So I could just start there. I could say there's some band structure for this short nanowire. It's got some E of K. I could begin with that. And we saw how when we computed the total number of electrons in the device, it divided into two parts. There was a density of states that could be filled by contact one multiplied by the Fermi function of contact one. Those are the red states. They can be filled by contact one because they have positive velocity. Electrons flow in from contact one. They can only occupy positive velocity states if we're ballistic, right? They only have positive velocities or they wouldn't have come in. And they're occupied according to the Fermi function of the contact. So this is, remember we divided the density of states into D1 and D2. Some that can be filled by contact one, some that can be filled by contact two. In the ideal case, when the contacts were equal, they divided in half. Half the states could be filled by contact one, half could be filled by contact two. The half that can be filled by contact one are the positive velocity half. And they were multiplied by an F1. The probability that each one of those states is occupied is given by the Fermi function of contact one. If I want to know the total current that's flowing in those red states, it's just a sum that we can evaluate. So we sum only over the positive K states. Those are the ones with positive velocities. Charge times the velocity, h bar k over m, if it's a simple band, times the probability that each of those states is occupied, and we just sum over all of the states. We get the total current flowing in the positive direction. Okay, contact two maybe have a slightly different Fermi level because we're talking about near equilibrium conduction. So it sends in electrons with negative velocities. They can occupy only part of the states, the part that have negative velocities. And the probability that each one of those is occupied is given by the Fermi function with Fermi level EF2. So I could compute the total current flowing in the negative direction just by summing over all of the negative velocity states, Q times Vx times the probability that they're occupied. So I'm going to get a large positive current flowing and a large negative current flowing. And if I want the net current, I just subtract the two. And if the Fermi levels are just a little bit different, I'll find that the net current is 2q squared over h times the voltage, just like before. Just another way of doing the same problem. Now, one of the things you should notice when you do this, it's sort of like a p-n junction in equilibrium, where there's an enormous drift current in one direction, there's an enormous diffusion current in the other direction, and at equilibrium, they balance and nothing is happening. So when you divide it up this way, it looks like there's an enormous current flowing in one direction, there's an enormous current flowing in the other direction, and the net current that flows is just a small difference between those two. But really, if you look at this, there are only a few states that actually carry current. There are a few states here that are occupied because the contact Fermi level 1 is above the contact Fermi level 2. So there are a few more positive velocity states occupied than negative velocity states. All of the ones below that don't contribute anything to the current because every positive velocity has a negative velocity. So it's kind of misleading when we say current is total carrier density times velocity times charge, because most of the carriers aren't carrying any current. You know, the ones below both Fermi levels aren't carrying any current. Okay, now let's look at an energy band diagram. So this is one of the first things you learn in a semiconductor course. If I have an N plus, say, lightly doped N-type resistor, and then an N plus second contact, if I draw an equilibrium energy band diagram, it will look like this. Fermi level is constant. Above the conduction band in the two contacts, and let's say I'm lightly doped inside the resistor itself, there's a built-in potential at both ends. Just a simple little energy band diagram. Now, if you apply a bias, what does the energy band diagram look like?
Band will go up or down depending on where we have applied the bias.
What goes up and down?
The contact where we have applied.
So if we apply a bias, we attach the voltage to the second contact, positive voltage lowers the Fermi level, we pull it down. And the way we would draw this in 606 is the equilibrium one is this dashed line. When we apply a bias, there's just a uniform slope. And very little drop across the junctions, because that region is still highly conductive. Most of the drop, virtually all of the drop, occurs across the long resistor itself. And it leads to an electric field there that's just voltage divided by length. Uniform constant electric field. This is how we compute the resistance. The velocity is mu times the electric field. You know, it's constant everywhere. And then we draw this thing called a quasi-Fermi level, which we haven't talked about yet. I mean, that's a concept that comes in diffusive near equilibrium transport. And the quasi-Fermi level under these conditions would drop uniformly. And if I wanted the electron density anywhere within the semiconductor, it would depend on the difference between the conduction band and the quasi-Fermi level, and that's constant everywhere. So the electron density is constant, just like it was in equilibrium, right? We have this concept of quasi-Fermi levels. But the ballistic problem was different. There was no quasi-Fermi level. There were two different equilibrium Fermi levels. And we didn't ask what's the quasi-Fermi level inside, because that wasn't very well defined in equilibrium. So we just worried about the Fermi level in contact 1 and the Fermi level in contact 2. They filled all of the states in between, and there was no quasi-Fermi level inside. So it's interesting to ask then, if you apply a bias, what does the energy band diagram really look like in a ballistic resistor? And this takes a little bit of discussion. The resistor itself has no resistance. There's no reason that the voltage should drop across the resistor. It's like the mobility is infinite. There isn't any potential drop across the resistor itself. Where the drop is going to occur is at the contact. So what would happen is that if we apply a bias, our Fermi levels will move down, and you know, depending on how we reference voltages, either it all occurs at one contact or it all occurs at the other contact, or it all occurs halfway in between. So if I apply a bias and I apply it equally to both contacts, I lower the Fermi level in the first one by half the applied bias. But I also lower the built-in potential of the first contact. There was some built-in potential there to begin with, VBI. Now it's lowered by half the applied bias. It's a little bit lower. And at the other end, the other half of the bias is applied, and we lower the potential, and the built-in potential at that end increases by contact two. Now, you know, you can argue that this has to occur because inside we have to maintain the electron density where it was in equilibrium. You know, the assumption is that in this resistor, we apply a small bias, the electron density stays where it was in equilibrium. The Poisson equation will readjust itself and move the bands up and down, so that will happen. And because there is no Fermi, quasi-Fermi level that's spatially varying, these states are always filled by this Fermi level, just a number. The blue states are all filled by this. So you can convince yourself that in order to get the carrier density constant in the resistor, the potential profile has to be flat in the resistor. All of the voltage is going to drop at the contacts of a ballistic resistor. So that's a little bit different. Is there a question?
But is this the electrostatic potential or electrochemical potential?
So the question is this the electrostatic potential or is it the electrochemical potential? The conduction band diagram is which? The EC of X is which potential?
It's the electrostatic.
It's the electrostatic potential.
But then if I apply a bias, then I expect a uniform drop from the drain to the source, and I don't expect a flat band diagram if I apply a bias, right? Because what's keeping the band flat at that? Because the electrochemical potential, then you would argue, since the transport is ballistic, then it's probably...
Well, so if you apply a bias, you're going to move the Fermi levels are like electrochemical potentials out of equilibrium. If you apply a bias, you're going to move them. That's clear. Now, the question is, are you going to move this inside? Now, our assumption is going to be, and here it's a little bit subtle. You know, let's say you're doped. ND. You want the electron density in there to be ND so that you're neutral. That's typically the set. The Poisson equation is going to make sure that that happens. So because all of these states are filled by two constant Fermi levels, after that Poisson equation is satisfied, you're going to be constant inside. And what you will find is that the only place that the potential has changed is right at the edges, because you've maintained a constant electrostatic potential inside so that Poisson is happy and you have a constant electron density inside. Typical case. It's very hard to induce a charge imbalance in a semiconductor. If it's short, that can happen, but doesn't typically happen. Now, there's another way you can think about this. You know, we have a Fermi level in contact one. That Fermi level fills all of the positive velocity states inside the device are filled by that Fermi level. So it's like a constant quasi-Fermi level for plus velocity electrons. We have a Fermi level in contact two. All of the negative velocity states inside the resistor are filled with that. That's like a quasi-Fermi level for the negative velocity electrons. Okay, we're near equilibrium. We have almost exactly the same number of positive velocity and negative velocity electrons. If we want to define a quasi-Fermi level, so that we go back and connect to EE606, the logical thing to do would be to take the average of the two. Oh, right. There's only one Fermi level in each of the contacts, and it's been shifted by the applied bias. Inside, Half of them respond with one Fermi level, half of them respond with the other. So the average Fermi level is halfway in between. So if you associate the potential drop here with the quasi-Fermi level or the electrochemical potential, you can see the only place it's changing is at the contacts. Right? This is why 2q squared over h is frequently called a quantum contact resistance. It's associated with things that happen at the contacts. Now, electrostatic potentials generally like to follow electrochemical potentials. But electrostatic potentials have this screening. They can't follow this. They can't follow this abruptly. You know, this takes some finite difference for the Poisson equation to smooth out potential changes. And that's why the electrostatic potential is rounded. That's the built-in potential at contact one, contact two, and then it's flat in between. Okay. So I should have brought one more picture. If some of you have looked at, say, some of you have done simulations of conduction band diagrams in nanoscale MOSFETs, ballistic MOSFETs. You know, we have a lot of people here who do NEGF simulations and things. And you'll apply maybe a larger drain bias. This will be a short channel length, maybe 50 nanometers these days. And it'll be a ballistic MOSFET, say. We do a lot of those simulations. And the potential won't be constant, even though it's ballistic. Yeah. Now, why is that? Sometimes people ask me that question. If you say this is a ballistic MOSFET, but the potential isn't constant in the channel.
Because drain field will also affect.
Yeah, this little region here, we're thinking here of a long resistor, and we have some electric field at the end where all of the business happens. If we have a 25 nanometer channel length, this region here, especially if we apply a large voltage, is going to penetrate in. The influence of the drain field is going to penetrate in and cause this thing to slope, even though it is ballistic. And then the electron density won't be constant or anything like that. So that's just a geometric effect. All right, any questions? All right, so let's talk about 2D and 3D resistors, and then we'll be done with resistors. So a 2D resistor looks like this. It's a sheet. It has some width W, and we expect the conductance to be proportional to the width. And we know that the key factor in computing the conductance is going to be the number of conducting channels at any given energy. And we saw how to compute that, but we also saw that a simple physical interpretation is that it's just the number of half wavelengths that fit into the width. So the higher the energy, the shorter the electron wavelength is, and the more half wavelengths that fit in. Each one of those is a separate conducting channel. Now, there are also additional conducting channels due to the fact that we're confined. Let's call this the Z direction, the thin direction. So there's current that can flow in the first confined state in the Z direction. There's current that can flow in the second confined state. So those are also modes. And I would have to add those modes too. So I would have to sum over all of the modes in the vertical direction. When we say we have a 2D conductor, what we're really saying is that we only have one or a few modes in the thin direction that are occupied, so that we can just count them up and add them. But we have a lot of modes in the width direction, too many to count. So we integrate over the width direction. All right. Okay, so it's also something worth pointing out here, I guess. If you look at this expression, you know, we talked about this. We had a whole lecture devoted to how we compute modes. You can see that this expression for the number of conducting channels at the Fermi level depends on the band structure. It depends on the effective mass. If I have a more complicated band structure, I would have to compute the number of modes at a given energy, and it would be different. I think I might have asked you to do that for a non-parabolic band structure. Or you could do it numerically if all you knew was a numerical E of K. But it's also worth pointing out that we know physically that the number of modes is the width of the resistor divided by the number of half wavelengths. So if I want to know the number of modes at the Fermi energy, I divide the width by the wavelength of electrons at the Fermi level, by half the wavelengths. All right. Well, 2 pi over k is 2 pi over lambda. So I could write this expression as w times the wave vector at the Fermi energy divided by pi. Same thing. All right. Now, let me go. I'm at t equals 0 now. Now, let me compute the electron density at t equals 0. So this is one of these basic things. All of the states up to a wave vector kf are occupied, probability 1. All of the states beyond that are not occupied. So there's a circle in the kx, ky plane with an area pi kf squared where all those states are occupied. Each state in 2D takes up 2 pi squared area in k space, and then you multiply by 2 for spin. So there's a simple relation between the carrier density and the wave vector. The wave vector is proportional to the square root of the carrier density. Okay. Meaning that in this expression, I can write the number of modes as 2 pi ns, 2 pi times the square root of 2 pi ns, whoops, is there an over pi? Yeah. So a square root of 2 ns over pi. Depends only on ns. So that's very nice. So if you have a field effect transistor, you very frequently know what the inversion layer density is. Band structure might be complicated. But if you know the inversion layer density, then you know the number of conducting channels, no matter what its band structure is, as long as you can make this T equals zero assumption. That frequently comes in handy. So we have these two cases that we can compute the resistance for. You know, ballistic transport, electrons just zip across, nothing stops them. The resistance is going to be independent of the length, because if it goes twice as far, it doesn't matter. And we have to worry about the fact that they come in at a whole spread of angles, and we take account of that when we compute the current. If we do diffusive transport, you know, the picture is something like this. The electron goes for a little while. On average, it's a mean-free path. Encounters something like a lattice vibration or an ionized impurity. Goes off at a different direction, encounters another one. Might get turned around. Might even bounce off some surface roughness at the edge of the width. And it just continues on this random walk. And eventually it gets out. It might get out contact 2, or it might go back contact 1. So when we're talking about mobility, or when we're talking about a classical resistor, the physical picture is something like this. And if we apply a small electric field, it's just a little more probable that they'll come out contact 2 than contact 1. So in diffusive transport, there's this random walk. Some of them terminate on contact 1 and some on contact 2. The average mean free path is lambda. When we say diffusive transport, we mean that the length is much, much longer than this lambda. So there's a true random walk. And it'll take a lot longer for the electrons to get out than if they do that ballistically. Okay, so we talked about the physics. You know, if I want to compute the conductance, I just go back to my general model, and now it's just mathematics. You know, but you want to have a physical picture. So I talked about the physical picture of that T. You know, ballistically, electrons just zip across probability 1. Nothing stops them from getting out. Diffusively, P is lambda over L. That's just the small probability that it will get out the other side. And if it's anywhere in between, I have a more general expression for T. We've talked about the physical understanding of the number of conducting channels, and we can derive that easily in 1, 2, or 3D. We can evaluate this integral easily at T equals 0, and we're going to get a result that's just like the 1D result. The conductance is the quantum of conductance times the transmission at the Fermi energy. So it's just going to be mean free path at the Fermi energy divided by mean free path plus length times the number of conducting channels at the Fermi energy. Easy to do. And in the ballistic case, we just get 2q squared over m times the number of conducting channels. And the conductance is proportional to the width. And it's proportional to the width because the number of conducting channels is proportional to the width. In the diffusive limit, the conductance is proportional to w over l. W because the number of channels goes as w, l because the transmission decreases as 1 over l. And you can see that the diffusive conductance is just the ballistic conductance times this ratio, mean free path divided by length. All right, now what if we're at finite temperatures? All right, we have the same starting point. We simply have to do this integration at finite temperatures. When we do that integration, it's easiest to do if I have a constant mean free path. If I have an energy-dependent mean-free path, I just have to put in the known energy dependence for it when I compute the integral. And I'll end up with Fermi-Dirac integrals and a little more complicated expression. All right. So physically, you like to think about conductance as being 2q squared over h times average transmission times number of channels. When you analyze real experiments, you're often at room temperature. You're often in this limit where you have to worry about things like what's the energy dependence of the mean free path and deal with Fermi-Dirac integrals. Okay, so you know, make sure you can go through that mathematics. As I said, I'm not going to do much of it here today. I'm just going to acquaint you with some things that you should be able to prove if you go through that. So let's see, at t equals zero, in the diffusive conductance, we have a simple expression for the conductance, right? So you should try not to memorize that so much. You know, it's like, it just makes so much sense, you never forget it, right? Quantum of conductance, transmission, number of channels. Classically, we like to write the conductance in 2D as some sheet conductance, ohm, mohs per square, times width over length, all right? And there's one thing here I have to tell you that you just have to believe for now, and we will see it in a few lectures down the road. You would expect, I think I've mentioned this once before, you would expect this mean free path to be velocity times average time between scattering events. It goes at some velocity and then it scatters. Now, it turns out that the way we've defined mean free path, it's actually pi over 2 times velocity times tau. And that has to do with this averaging over an angle. And we'll talk more about that later. Okay, so there are some things that you could show. If I wanted to evaluate the sheet conductance, I would just start with the expression on top and I would factor out a W over L. And everything left would be my sheet conductance. So 2q squared over h, that is units of mohs, times mean free path times number of modes per unit width. Yeah, okay. M is just a number. M divided by W is inverse centimeters. Lambda is in centimeters, so it has the right units. Right, that's not the way classically we're used to seeing it, but right, that's what we would get the way we do it. Classically, you would write sheet conductance is N, Q, mu. Okay? And if you do that, go through the math, it's good to do, you'll find that you can write this first expression as N, Q, mu, and mu will end up being Q tau over M, just like you thought it should be. Now, there's another way to write this, and I just mentioned it here because you will frequently see this when you read papers. And when you see this in a paper, you shouldn't think that this is something different, because this is the way you compute conductance, this equation on the top, right? That's the right way to do it. You can write it in lots of different ways. You can write it as nq mu, all right? It's the same thing in the diffusive limit. Or you can write it as q squared times the density of states at the Fermi level times the diffusion coefficient of electrons at the Fermi energy. When you read papers, especially in the physics literature, you'll frequently see people writing the sheet conductance this way. You should be able to show, just by these definitions and inserting it into the top expression in the red square, that you can obtain this. And the definition of diffusion coefficient is velocity squared times tau divided by 2. So you can see that's like the thing we've talked about before. It's velocity times the velocity times tau, which is mean free path, divided by 2. All right. So I just want to point out, when you read papers, you'll see people doing this frequently. It's really best not to start here with things like n, q, mu, because you don't know when that's, you know it works in the diffusive limit. You're not quite sure when you should use it and when you shouldn't. If you start with our general expression, Landauer expression, it always works. And then you can reduce it if you need to. So that's all I want to say about 2D. Ballistic conductance is independent of the length, but it's proportional to W because the number of channels is proportional to W. The diffusive conductance is proportional to W over L because transmission is proportional to 1 over L. The number of transverse modes depends on the band structure if we want to know the number of transverse modes at a particular energy. But if I want to know the number of transverse modes at a given carrier density, it's independent of band structure, at least at T equals 0. It'll depend a little bit when I go to non-zero. All right. Any questions before we look at an example or two? All right, so then let's take an example. So we go in the lab, we measure a transistor. This is a reasonably current transistor. It's a little bit out of date. I think the mask channel length is 100 nanometers. The physical channel length is 60 nanometers. It's an N-channel MOSFET. It's got IV characteristics that look just like any MOSFET. And if I apply a small drain bias, then I think of the channel as a resistor. And the question is, how close is the channel resistance in a modern silicon MOSFET to the ballistic channel resistance? Well, if you go in and measure, what you do is you just take a small drain voltage, you measure the current, and voltage divided by current gives you the resistance. That resistance is the sum of the series resistance due to the metal contacts on the source and the drain, plus the actual channel resistance. So we have to subtract out the series resistance because that depends on the metal semiconductor contact resistance and other technology parameters. And we want to know the intrinsic channel. How close is it to ballistic? So the series resistance on devices these days, the sum of the series resistance at the source end and the drain end is roughly 200 ohm micrometers. Okay, those units mean if the transistor is 1 micrometer wide, the total series resistance is 200 ohms. But you divide by the width. If it's 2 micrometers wide, then it's half of this, etc. And we want to find out how close we are. All right. So, we go back to our expressions. We know that the channel conductance is transmission times the ballistic conductance. And the question we want to ask is, how close to the ballistic conductance are we? So we're really asking, what is the transmission coefficient for a modern MOSFET? What is lambda over lambda plus L? And I'll think of lambda as being constant, not having some complicated energy dependence, or it's some average lambda. We're just doing a back-of-the-envelope calculation. So the mobility in this particular MOSFET was measured to be about 260 centimeters squared per volt second. Okay, so it could be higher if it were strained, but this isn't a strained silicon MOSFET. Now, we remember, one of these things that it's useful to carry around is that the diffusion coefficient is thermal velocity times mean free path divided by 2. We've seen that a few times. It's really helpful to carry that around in the back of your head. We remember that thermal velocity is square root of 2kT over pi m. That's also a number. That's the average velocity of the positive velocity electrons when they're non-degenerate. no Fermi-Dirac integrals. That may be suspect if we're doing this under high gate bias, but it's a starting point anyway. It'll get us close. That number for silicon is 1.2 times 10 to the 7th centimeters per second. For that calculation, I use an effective mass of 0.19. And I think we talked about this. You have to be careful about these ellipsoids. The electrons in the lowest subband are going to have an effective mass in the plane that's the light effective mass, transverse effective mass, and that's why I use that. So now you just plug numbers in. And you find a diffusion coefficient. We are low bias. We're near equilibrium. D over mu is KT over Q. We get a mean free path of 14 nanometers. If I wanted to be more careful, if I was really analyzing some experiment and my thesis depended on this, I would work it all out at 300K with Fermi-Dirac integrals. I might worry about whether two subbands are occupied. I might do a Schrodinger-Poisson solver and try to do the whole thing more carefully. But we're just trying a back-of-the-envelope calculation. So the mean free path is roughly 14 nanometers. The physical channel length is about 60 nanometers. So the transmission ends up being something like 20%. So the ballistic conductance is 20%, or the actual conductance is 20% of the ballistic conductance. Take 1 over that. The channel resistance in a modern MOSFET is about 5 times the ballistic resistance. All right. We're within an order of magnitude. We're within a point where people are starting to worry about this. People that want to be very careful about things on SPICE models are, worry about this component. You're even starting to see it added into SPICE models. Now, if I go to a 3-5 MOSFET, something that has an indium gallium arsenide channel, I could do the same calculation. And here we did this for a nano wire, and we'll get the same story for a planar 2D FET. The mobility can be very high, 10,000. I'll estimate the diffusion coefficient in the same way. The thermal velocity is quite a bit higher than in silicon because the effective mass is quite a bit lighter. You work out the mean free path, and it's really very long. So if I'm talking about a 60 nanometer 3-5 MOSFET and comparing it to a 60 nanometer silicon MOSFET, the mean free path is actually longer than the channel length. So the transmission is close to 1. So we're in this regime where the ballistic resistance and the channel resistance, neither one of them can really be ignored. The ballistic resistance is actually a little more important than the channel resistance. So these are really, these are things, all of this ballistic quantum contact resistance is things that low temperature physicists worried about 20 years ago, and now room temperature device engineers need to be worrying about them. All right. Now you might also ask, in one of these MOSFETs, how many conducting channels are there? Is it a few? Are there many? Do we have to really start worrying about the fact that they look more like a wire than like a 2D device with many subbands? Well, we have an expression for the number. We saw that we could relate that also to the wave vector, and that we can relate the wave vector to the carrier density. So we can estimate the number of channels if we know what the carrier density is and what the valley degeneracy is. So the carrier density is something that you typically know. It's like Cox Vg minus Vt. And it's useful if you're calibrated to silicon MOSFETs. You'll know that you can get almost 10 to the 13th per square centimeter in a silicon MOSFET under on-current conditions. And there were 2 of those valleys because of this band structure of silicon. It's harder to get as many carriers in an in-gas HEMT. You get more like 2 times 10 to the 12th, and there's a valley degeneracy of 1. Plug numbers in, and you get between 100 and 200 modes per micrometer of width. Now, a 1 micron MOSFET is pretty wide. What if you had a minimum size transistor, 60 nanometers long with a width of 60 nanometers? 60 nanometers is how many microns? 0.06. So it's roughly 100 or 200. So you have something like 6 to 12 conducting channels. Right? Starting to get down to a relatively small number. Right? You might worry about whether you should be treating this more as a nanowire, where you can count individual modes rather than as a big 2D plane. So these are all, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, I'm hoping that you'll take away from the course. You'll be able to do the calculation when you need to do it to analyze your experiment, but you'll be able to do some back-of-the-envelope calculations when you have to. All right, let's take a look at an example with graphene. This is an example where, remember, graphene has these conical bands, and when you do these measurements, you put graphene on SiO2, and you use the silicon wafer underneath as a gate, and you apply a voltage, and that moves the bands up and down, and you're basically moving the Fermi level up in the conduction band, so you get more conductance, or up in the valence band, and you get more conductance, and you go through this Dirac point where there are no states, and you get very little conductance. So we could ask some questions here about, if we measure the conductance here, the sheet conductance, it's 3 millisiemens, we can figure out what the carrier density is, because there's an oxide capacitance, there's a gate voltage applied, gate oxide capacitance times gate voltage is going to give me Q times the carrier density. So I could ask the question, how close is this measured conductance to the ballistic limit? And what is the mean free path in this device? Is it ballistic or is it diffusive? So I'd go back to my expressions. So I can use the T equals zero expressions. What I want to do is compute the ballistic conductance. To compute the ballistic conductance, I have to know where the Fermi level is. But in order to know where the Fermi level is, the carrier density depends on where the Fermi level is. Experimentally, I know the carrier density. It's C times the gate voltage. So from the known carrier density, I can compute the Fermi energy. From the known Fermi energy, I can plug it in and compute the number of transverse modes. From the number of transverse modes, I can compute the ballistic conductance. And I can see whether this sample is close to the ballistic conductance or not. And if you do that, what you'll find is, you know that the measured conductance is some fraction of the ballistic conductance. The fraction is mean free path divided by the length of the resistance. The length of the resistor was 5,000 nanometers. So you can do the calculations, and we find that the mean free path is about 130 nanometers in this particular sample. So the measured sheet conductance is about the ballistic conductance divided by 40. So this is a diffusive graphene sample. All right, so these are the kinds of things that you can do, and I don't think this is quite online lit yet, but you can see a whole seminar where Dionysus helped me put together much more analysis on this. Let me also talk about this. You could ask, what's the mobility of graphene? Now, when you ask a question like this, you say, well, the mobility is Q tau over M. It's not clear what to do. So how do you, someone asks you, what's the mobility of graphene? Here's the way I would do that. I would start with an expression that I know, I understand the physics. And I would equate it to NQ mobility times W over L. And I would use that as my definition of mobility. So all I have to do now is to plug in numbers. I know every one of those quantities. I know what the number of conducting channels is. I know how the mean free path is related to velocity. I know how the carrier density is related to Fermi energy. And if you do it, you find that the mobility is Q tau, not over M, because M is kind of an unclear quantity in graphene, but it's Q tau over Fermi energy divided by Fermi velocity squared. That's what it is in graphene. Okay, so we can do 3D resistors very, very quickly, because there's no point in belaboring this much longer. 3D, we have a big chunk. We have a large cross-sectional area. We have a length that might be short or long compared to a mean free path. So if the cross-sectional area is large, then we really don't have much quantum confinement. If it's small, it's a nanowire. If it's big, we have lots of transverse states. And I can compute the density of states, but I can also compute the number of modes at a given energy. And the way I do that is I figure out the number of half wavelengths that fit into this cross-sectional area. You know, it's got to fit into the x direction and the y direction. So the number of modes now is going to be proportional to the cross-sectional area. Bigger the area is, the more the modes. In 2D, it was proportional to the width. In 1D, I just counted the number of subbands. And I had to assume a specific dispersion in order to compute that. If I had non-parabolic bands or something else, or graph, yeah, I don't have 3D graphene, so I can't do that for graphene. So we go back. Our expression for conductance works in any dimension. It works whether it's diffusive, it works whether it's ballistic. That's why we like it so much. It's easy for us to calculate the number of modes in 3D. Transmission is the same. So I can see that the ballistic conductance in 3D is proportional to the cross-sectional area because the number of conducting channels is proportional to the cross-sectional area. I can see that the diffusive conductance is proportional to A over L because the transmission goes as 1 over L, and that's what I expect classically. And in the diffusive limit, I could also write it as NQ mu times A over L, which is what we're used to doing. Right. And I could use that to derive what the mobility is. If I have to evaluate this thing at finite temperatures, then if I assume a constant mean free path, I have a Fermi-Dirac integral to worry about. Every dimension, I get a different integral. If the mean free path has some energy dependence, I would get an integral with a different order. But it's just math that we can do. And at t equals 0, it works out nice and simply. All right. So we know everything. We know what we need to know about resistance. We have this general formula. We understand physically what the number of conducting channels is and how we get that. We understand what transmission is, although we haven't yet talked about scattering. And we'll talk about those microscopic scattering processes later in the course. We understand when this connects to the traditional 606 level description. And when you look at this expression, it's not just math. When we look at that minus df dE, we think about these two contacts separated by a small voltage, and it's just a way to write F1 minus F2 when F2 is just a little bit different than F1. Works in 1D, 2D, or 3D. The units are always 1 over ohms. And we saw how it varies with width, area, and length, and that all makes good, strong physical sense. And you know, we see things how we can get the ballistic conductance, which gives us a lower limit to the resistance. So these are things, you know, you go in and use a commercial CAD package, say you're designing an electronic device. It may well spit out to you a resistance that's lower than the ballistic resistance. Right? You should be able to recognize that because most of those CAD tools are designed for the diffusive limits. They don't comprehend ballistic limits. But devices have dimensions now that you can be operating in that regime, and you have to be able to understand that. All right. Any questions? All right. So for those of you that are getting bored, we're going to move on to something different on Friday. I'll see you then.